stained from bad loves, and to her body of a wild dog, hardened and without a soul, which prepared itself to dismiss him as if he were a frightened child. And suddenly it found a man whose tremendous power demanded a movement of seismic readjustment from her insides. They became lovers. Aureliano would spend his mornings deciphering parchments, and at siesta time he would go to the bedroom, where Nigromanta was waiting for him, to teach him first how to do it like earthworms, then like snails, and finally like crabs, until she had to leave him and lie in wait for vagabond loves. Several weeks passed before Aureliano discovered that around her waist she wore a small belt that seemed to be made out of a cello string, but which was as hard as steel and had no end, as if it had been born and grown with her. Almost always, between loves, they would eat naked in the bed, in the hallucinating heat and under the daytime stars that the rust had caused to shine on the zinc ceiling. It was the first time that Nigromanta had had a steady man, a bone crusher from head to toe, as she herself said, dying with laughter. And she had even begun to get romantic illusions when Aureliano confided in her about his repressed passion for Amaranta Ursula, which he had not been able to cure with the substitution, but which was twisting him inside all the more as experience broadened the horizons of love. After that, Nigromanta continued to receive him with the same warmth as ever, but she made him pay for her services so strictly that when Aureliano had no money, she would make an addition to his bill, which was not figured in numbers but by marks that she made with her thumbnail behind the door. At sundown, while she was drifting through the shadows in the square, Aureliano was going along the porch like a stranger, scarcely greeting Amaranta Ursula and Gaston, who usually dined at that time, and shutting himself up in his room again, unable to read or write or even think because of the anxiety brought on by the laughter, the whispering, the preliminary frolics, and then the explosions of agonizing happiness that capped the nights in the house. That was his life, 2 years before Gaston began to wait for the airplane, and it went on the same way on the afternoon that he went to the bookstore of the Wise Catalonian and found 4 ranting boys in a heated argument about the methods used to kill cockroaches in the Middle Ages. The old bookseller, knowing about Aureliano's love for books that had been read only by the venerable Bede, urged him, with a certain fatherly malice, to get into the discussion, and without even taking a breath, he explained that the cockroach, the oldest winged insect on the face of the earth, had already been the victim of slippers in the Old Testament, but that since the species was definitely resistant to any and all methods of extermination, from tomato slices with borax to flour and sugar, and with its 1,603 varieties, had resisted the most ancient, tenacious, and pitiless persecution that mankind had unleashed against any living thing since the beginnings, including man himself, to such an extent that just as an instinct for reproduction was attributed to humankind, so there must have been another one, more definite and pressing, which was the instinct to kill cockroaches, and if the latter had succeeded in escaping human ferocity, it was because they had taken refuge in the shadows, where they became invulnerable because of man's congenital fear of the dark. But on the other hand, they became susceptible to the glow of noon, so that by the Middle Ages already, and in present times, and per omnia secular seculorum, the only effective method for killing cockroaches was the glare of the sun. That encyclopedic coincidence was the beginning of a great friendship. Aureliano continued getting together in the afternoon with the 4 arguers, whose names were Álvaro, Germán, Alfonso, and Gabriel, the first and last friends that he ever had in his life. For a man like him, holed up in written reality, those stormy sessions that began in the bookstore and ended at dawn in the brothels were a revelation. It had never occurred to him until then to think that literature was the best plaything that had ever been invented to make fun of people, as Álvaro demonstrated during one night of revels. Some time would have to pass before Aureliano realized that such arbitrary attitudes had their origins in the example of the wise Catalonian, for whom wisdom was worth nothing if it could not be used to invent a new way of preparing chickpeas. The afternoon on which Aureliano gave his lecture on cockroaches, the argument ended up in the house of the girls who went to bed because of hunger, a brothel of lies on the outskirts of Macondo. The proprietress was a smiling Mama Santa, tormented by a mania for opening and closing doors. Her eternal smile seemed to have been brought on by the credulity of her customers, who accepted as something certain an establishment that did not exist except in the imagination, because even the tangible things there were unreal. The furniture that fell apart when one sat on it, the disemboweled phonograph with a nesting hen inside, the garden of paper flowers, the calendars going back to the years before the arrival of the Banana Company, the frames with prints cut out of magazines that had never been published. Even the timid little whores who came from the neighborhood, when the proprietress informed them that customers had arrived, they were nothing but an invention. They would appear without any greeting in their little flower dresses, left over from days when they were 5 years younger, and they took them off with the same innocence with which they had put them on, and in the paroxysms of love they would exclaim, "Good heavens, look how that roof is falling in," and as soon as they got their peso and 50 cents, they would spend it on a roll with cheese that the proprietress sold them, smiling more than ever, because only she knew that that meal was not true either. Aureliano, whose world at that time began with Melquiades parchments and ended in Nigromanta's bed, found a stupid cure for timidity in the small imaginary brothel. At first he could get nowhere, in rooms where the proprietress would enter during the best moments of love and make all sorts of comments about the intimate charms of the protagonists. But with time he began to get so familiar with those misfortunes of the world that on one night that was more unbalanced than the others, he got undressed in the small reception room and ran through the house balancing a bottle of beer on his inconceivable maleness. He was the one who made fashionable the extravagances that the proprietress celebrated with her eternal smile, without protesting, without believing in them, just as when Herman tried to burn the house down to show that it did not exist, and as when Alfonso wrung the neck of the parrot and threw it into the pot where the chicken stew was beginning to boil. Although Aureliano felt himself linked to the four friends by a common affection and a common solidarity, even to the point where he thought of them as if they were one person, he was closer to Gabriel than to the others. The link was born on the night when he casually mentioned Colonel Aureliano Buendia, and Gabriel was the only one who did not think that he was making fun of somebody. Even the proprietress, who normally did not take part in the conversations, argued with a madam's wrathful passion that Colonel Aureliano Buendia, of whom she had indeed heard speak at some time, was a figure invented by the government as a pretext for killing liberals. Gabriel, on the other hand, did not doubt the reality of Colonel Aureliano Buendia, because he had been a companion in arms and inseparable friend of his great-great-grandfather, Colonel Gerineldo Marquez. Those fickle tricks of memory were even more critical when the killing of the workers was brought up. Every time that Aureliano mentioned the matter, not only the proprietress, but some people older than she, would repudiate the myth of the workers hemmed in at the station and the train with 200 cars loaded with dead people, and they would even insist that, after all, everything had been set forth in judicial documents and in primary school textbooks, that the Banana Company had never existed, so that Aureliano and Gabriel were linked by a kind of complicity based on real facts that no one believed in, and which had affected their lives to the point that both of them found themselves off course in the tide of a world that had ended and of which only the nostalgia remained. Gabriel would sleep wherever time overtook him. Aureliano put him up several times in the silver workshop, but he would spend his nights awake, disturbed by the noise of the dead people who walked through the bedrooms until dawn. Later he turned him over to Nigromanta, who took him to her well-used room when she was free, and put down his account with vertical marks behind the door in the few spaces left free by Aureliano's debts. In spite of their disordered life, the whole group tried to do something permanent at the urging of the wise Catalonian. It was he, with his experience as a former professor of classical literature and his storehouse of rare books, who got them to spend a whole night in search of the 37th dramatic situation in a town where no one had any interest any more in going beyond primary school. Fascinated by the discovery of friendship, bewildered by the enchantments of a world which had been forbidden to him by Fernanda's meanness, Aureliano abandoned the scrutiny of the parchments precisely when they were beginning to reveal themselves as predictions in coded lines of poetry. But the subsequent proof that there was time enough for everything without having to give up the brothels gave him the drive to return to Melquiades' room, having decided not to flag in his efforts until he had discovered the last keys. That was during the time that Gaston began to wait for the airplane, and Amaranta Ursula was so lonely that one morning she appeared in the room.
"Hello, cannibal," she said to him. "Back in your cave again?"
She was irresistible, with a dress she had designed, and one of the long shad vertebra necklaces that she herself had made. She had stopped using the leash, convinced of her husband's faithfulness, and for the first time since her return she seemed to have a moment of ease. Aureliano did not need to see her to know that she had arrived. She put her elbows on the table, so close and so helpless, that Aureliano heard the deep sound of her bones, and she became interested in the parchments. Trying to overcome his disturbance, he grasped at the voice that he was losing, the life that was leaving him, the memory that was turning into a petrified polyp, and he spoke to her about the priestly destiny of Sanskrit, the scientific possibility of seeing the future, showing through in time as one sees what is written on the back of a sheet of paper through the light, the necessity of deciphering the predictions so that they would not defeat themselves, and the centuries of Nostradamus, and the destruction of Cantabria, predicted by Saint Milanus. Suddenly, without interrupting the chat, moved by an impulse that had been sleeping in him since his origins, Aureliano put his hand on hers, thinking that that final decision would put an end to his doubts. She grabbed his index finger with the affectionate innocence with which she had done so in childhood, however, and she held it while he kept on answering questions. They remained like that, linked by icy index fingers that did not transmit anything in any way, until she awoke from her momentary dream and slapped her forehead with her hand. "The ants!" she exclaimed, and then she forgot about the manuscripts, went to the door with a dance step, and from there she threw Aureliano a kiss with the tips of her fingers as she had said goodbye to her father on the afternoon when they sent her to Brussels. "You can tell me later," she said. "I forgot that today's the day to put quicklime on the ant hills." She continued going to the room occasionally when she had something to do in that part of the house, and she would stay there for a few minutes while her husband continued to scrutinize the sky. Encouraged by that change, Aureliano stayed to eat with the family at that time, as he had not done since the first months of Amaranta Ursula's return. Gaston was pleased. During the conversations after meals, which usually went on for more than an hour, he complained that his partners were deceiving him. They had informed him of the loading of the airplane on board a ship that did not arrive, and although his shipping agents insisted that it would never arrive, because it was not on the list of Caribbean ships, his partners insisted that the shipment was correct, and they even insinuated that Gaston was lying to them in his letters. The correspondence reached such a degree of mutual suspicion that Gaston decided not to write again, and he began to suggest the possibility of a quick trip to Brussels to clear things up, and return with the airplane. The plan evaporated, however, as soon as Amaranta Ursula reiterated her decision not to move from Macondo, even if she lost her husband. During the first days, Aureliano shared the general opinion that Gaston was a fool on a velocipede, and that brought on a vague feeling of pity. Later, when he obtained deeper information on the nature of men in the brothels, he thought that Gaston's meekness had its origins in unbridled passion. But when he came to know him better, and realized that his true character was the opposite of his submissive conduct, he conceived the malicious suspicion that even the wait for the airplane was an act. Then he thought that Gaston was not as foolish as he appeared, but, quite the contrary, was a man of infinite steadiness, ability, and patience, who had set about to conquer his wife with the weariness of eternal agreement, of never saying no, of simulating a limitless conformity, letting her become enmeshed in her own web until the day she could no longer bear the tedium of the illusions close at hand and would pack the bags herself to go back to Europe. Aureliano's former pity turned into a violent dislike. Gaston's system seemed so perverse to him, but at the same time so effective, that he ventured to warn Amaranta Ursula. She made fun of his suspicions, however, without even noticing the heavy weight of love, uncertainty, and jealousy that he had inside. It had not occurred to her that she was arousing something more than fraternal affection in Aureliano until she pricked her finger trying to open a can of peaches, and he dashed over to suck the blood out, with an avidity and a devotion that sent a chill up her spine.
"Aureliano!"
she laughed, disturbed.
"You're too suspicious to be a good bat."
Then Aureliano went all out, giving her some small orphaned kisses in the hollow of her wounded hand. He opened up the most hidden passageways of his heart and drew out an interminable and lacerated intestine, the terrible parasitic animal that had incubated in his martyrdom. He told her how he would get up at midnight to weep in loneliness and rage over the underwear that she had left to dry in the bathroom. He told her about the anxiety with which he had asked Nigromante to howl like a cat and sob, "Gaston, Gaston, Gaston," in his ear, and with how much astuteness he had ransacked her vials of perfume so that he could smell it on the necks of the little girls who went to bed because of hunger. Frightened by the passion of that outburst, Amaranta Ursula was closing her fingers, contracting them like a shellfish, until her wounded hand, free of all pain and any vestige of pity, was converted into a knot of emeralds and topazes and stony and unfeeling bones.
"Phew!"
she said, as if she was spitting.
"I'm sailing on the first ship leaving for Belgium."
Álvaro had come to the wise Catalonian's bookstore one of those afternoons, proclaiming at the top of his lungs his latest discovery, a zoological brothel. It was called the Golden Child, and it was a huge open-air salon through which no less than 200 bitterns, who told the time with a deafening cackling, strolled at will. In wire pens that surrounded the dance floor, and among large Amazonian camellias, there were herons of different colours, crocodiles as fat as pigs, snakes with 12 rattles, and a turtle with a gilded shell who dove in a small artificial ocean. There was a big white dog, meek, and a pederast, who would give stud services, nevertheless, in order to be fed. The atmosphere had an innocent denseness, as if it had just been created, and the beautiful mulatto girls who waited hopelessly among the blood-red petals and the outmoded phonograph records knew ways of love that man had left behind, forgotten in the earthly paradise. The first night that the group visited that greenhouse of illusions, the splendid and taciturn old woman, who guarded the entrance in a wicker rocking chair, felt that time was turning back to its earliest origins, when among the five who were arriving she saw a bony, jaundiced man with tartar cheekbones, marked forever and from the beginning of the world with the pox of solitude.
"Lord, Lord," she sighed, "Aureliano."
She was seeing Colonel Aureliano Buendia once more, as she had seen him in the light of a lamp, long before the wars, long before the desolation of glory and the exile of disillusionment, that remote dawn when he went to her bedroom to give the first command of his life, the command to give him love. It was Pilar Ternera. Years before, when she had reached 145 years of age, she had given up the pernicious custom of keeping track of her age, and she went on living in the static and marginal time of memories, in a future perfectly revealed and established, beyond the futures disturbed by the insidious snares and suppositions of her cards. From that night on, Aureliano took refuge in the compassionate tenderness and understanding of his unknown great-great-grandmother. Sitting in her wicker rocking chair, she would recall the past, reconstruct the grandeur and misfortunes of the family and the splendor of Macondo, which was now erased, while Álvaro frightened the crocodiles with his noisy laughter, and Alfonso invented outlandish stories about the bitterns who had pecked out the eyes of four customers who misbehaved the week before, and Gabrielle was in the room of the pensive mulatto girl who did not collect in money but in letters to a smuggler boyfriend who was in prison on the other side of the Orinoco because the border guards had caught him and had made him sit on a chamber pot that filled up with a mixture of shit and diamonds. That true brothel, with that maternal proprietress, was the world of which Aureliano had dreamed during his prolonged captivity. He felt so well, so close to perfect companionship, that he thought of no other refuge on the afternoon on which Amaranta Ursula had made his illusions crumble. He was ready to unburden himself with words, so that someone could break the knots that bound his chest. But he only managed to let out a fluid, warm and restorative weeping in Pilar Ternera's lap. She let him finish, scratching his head with the tips of her fingers, and without his having revealed that he was weeping from love, she recognized immediately the oldest sobs in the history of man. "It's all right, child," she consoled him. "Now tell me who it is." When Aureliano told her, Pilar Ternera let out a deep laugh, the old expansive laugh that ended up as a cooing of doves. There was no mystery in the heart of a Buendia that was impenetrable for her, because a century of cards and experience had taught her that the history of the family was a machine with unavoidable repetitions, a turning wheel that would have gone on spilling into eternity were it not for the progressive and irremediable wearing of the axle. "Don't you worry," she said, smiling. "Wherever she is right now, she's waiting for you." It was 4:30 in the afternoon when Amaranta Ursula came out of her bath. Aureliano saw her go by his room with a robe of soft folds and a towel wrapped around her head like a turban. He followed her almost on tiptoes, stumbling from drunkenness, and he went into the nuptial bedroom just as she opened the robe and closed it again in fright. He made a silent signal toward the next room, where the door was half open, and where Aureliano knew that Gaston was beginning to write a letter.
"Go away," she said voicelessly.
Aureliano smiled, picked her up by the waist with both hands like a pot of begonias, and dropped her on her back on the bed. With a brutal tug he pulled off her bathrobe before she had time to resist, and he loomed over an abyss of newly washed nudity, whose skin color, lines of fuzz, and hidden moles had all been imagined in the shadows of the other rooms. Amaranta Ursula defended herself sincerely with the astuteness of a wise woman, weaseling her slippery, flexible, and fragrant weasel's body as she tried to knee him in the kidneys and scorpion his face with her nails. But without either of them giving a gasp that might not have been taken for the breathing of a person watching the meager April sunset through the open window. It was a fierce fight, a battle to the death, but it seemed to be without violence because it consisted of distorted attacks and ghostly evasions, slow, cautious, solemn, so that during it all there was time for the petunias to bloom and for Gaston to forget about his aviator's dreams in the next room, as if they were two enemy lovers seeking reconciliation at the bottom of an aquarium. In the heat of that savage and ceremonious struggle, Amaranta Ursula understood that her meticulous silence was so irrational that it could awaken the suspicions of her nearby husband much more than the sound of warfare that they were trying to avoid. Then she began to laugh with her lips tight together, without giving up the fight, but defending herself with false bites and de-weaseling her body little by little, until they both were conscious of being adversaries and accomplices at the same time, and the affray degenerated into a conventional gambol, and the attacks became caresses. Suddenly, almost playfully, like one more bit of mischief, Amaranta Ursula dropped her defense, and when she tried to recover, frightened by what she herself had made possible, it was too late. A great commotion immobilized her in her center of gravity, planted her in her place, and her defensive will was demolished by the irresistible anxiety to discover what the orange whistles and the invisible globes on the other side of death were like. She barely had time to reach out her hand and grope for the towel to put a gag between her teeth so that she would not let out the cat howls that were already tearing at her insides. Pilar Ternera died in her wicker rocking chair during one night of festivities, as she watched over the entrance to her paradise. In accordance with her last wishes, she was not buried in a coffin, but sitting in her rocker, which 8 men lowered by ropes into a huge hole dug in the center of the dance floor. The mulatto girls, dressed in black, pale from weeping, invented shadowy rites as they took off their earrings, brooches, and rings, and threw them into the pit before it was closed over with a slab that bore neither name nor dates, and that was covered with a pile of Amazonian camellias. After poisoning the animals, they closed up the doors and windows with brick and mortar, and they scattered out into the world with their wooden trunks, that were lined with pictures of saints, prints from magazines, and the portraits of sometime sweethearts, remote and fantastic, who shat diamonds or ate cannibals or were crowned playing card kings on the high seas. It was the end. In Pilar Tenera's tomb, among the psalms and cheap whore jewelry, the ruins of the past would rot. The little that remained after the wise Catalonian had auctioned off his bookstore and returned to the Mediterranean village where he had been born, overcome by a yearning for a lasting springtime. No one could have foreseen his decision. He had arrived in Macondo during the splendor of the Banana Company, fleeing from one of many wars, and nothing more practical had occurred to him than to set up that bookshop of incunabula and first editions in several languages, which casual customers would thumb through cautiously, as if they were junk books, as they waited their turn to have their dreams interpreted in the house across the way. He spent half his life in the back of the store, scribbling in his extra careful hand in purple ink, and on pages that he tore out of school notebooks, and no one was sure exactly what he was writing. When Aureliano first met him, he had two boxes of those motley pages that in some way made one think of Melchiades' parchments, and from that time, until he left, he had filled a third one, so it was reasonable to believe that he had done nothing else during his stay in Macondo. The only people with whom he maintained relations were the four friends, whom he had exchanged their tops and kites for books, and he set them to reading Seneca and Ovid while they were still in grammar school. He treated the classical writers with a household familiarity, as if they had all been his roommates at some period, and he knew many things that should not have been known, such as the fact that St. Augustine wore a wool jacket under his habit that he did not take off for 14 years, and that Arnaldo of Villanova, the necromancer, was impotent since childhood because of a scorpion bite. His fervour for the written word was an interweaving of solemn respect and gossipy irreverence. Not even his own manuscripts were safe from that dualism. Having learned Catalan in order to translate them, Alfonso put a roll of pages in his pockets, which were always full of newspaper clippings and manuals for strange trades, and one night he lost them in the house of the little girls who went to bed because of hunger. When the wise old grandfather found out, instead of raising a row, as had been feared, he commented, dying with laughter, that it was the natural destiny of literature. On the other hand, there was no human power capable of persuading him not to take along the three boxes when he returned to his native village, and he unleashed a string of Carthaginian curses at the railroad inspectors who tried to ship them as freight, until he finally succeeded in keeping them with him in the passenger coach. "The world must be all fucked up," he said then, "when men travel first class and literature goes as freight." That was the last thing he was heard to say. He had spent a dark week on the final preparations for the trip, because as the hour approached, his humour was breaking down and things began to be misplaced, and what he put in one place would appear in another, attacked by the same elves that had tormented Fernanda. "Coyons," he would curse, "I shit on Canon 27 of the Synod of London." Herman and Aureliano took care of him. They helped him like a child, fastening his tickets and immigration documents to his pockets with safety pins, making him a detailed list of what he must do from the time he left Macondo until he landed in Barcelona. But nonetheless, he threw away a pair of pants with half of his money in it without realizing it. The night before the trip, after nailing up the boxes and putting his clothing into the same suitcase that he had brought when he first came, he narrowed his clam eyes, pointed with a kind of impudent benediction at the stacks of books with which he had endured during his exile, and said to his friends, "All that shit there, I leave to you, people." 3 months later they received, in a large envelope, 29 letters and more than 50 pictures that he had accumulated during the leisure of the high seas. Although he did not date them, the order in which he had written the letters was obvious. In the first ones, with his customary good humour, he spoke about the difficulties of the crossing, the urge he had to throw the cargo officer overboard when he would not let him keep the three boxes in his cabin, the clear imbecility of a lady who was terrified at the number 13, not out of superstition, but because she thought it was a number that had no end, and the bet that he had won during the first dinner, because he had recognized in the drinking water on board the taste of the night-time beets by the springs of Lérida. With the passage of the days, however, the reality of life on board mattered less and less to him, and even the most recent and trivial happening seemed worthy of nostalgia, because as the ship got farther away, his memory began to grow sad. That process of nostalgia was also evident in the pictures. In the first ones he looked happy, with his sport shirt, which looked like a hospital jacket, and his snowy mane, in an October Caribbean filled with whitecaps. In the last ones, he could be seen to be wearing a dark coat and a silk scarf, pale in the face, taciturn from absence on the deck of a mournful ship that had come to be like a sleepwalker on the autumnal seas. Germán and Aureliano answered his letters. He wrote so many during the first months that at that time they felt closer to him than when he had been in Macondo, and they were almost freed from the rancor that he had left behind. At first he told them that everything was just the same, that the pink snails were still in the house where he had been born, that the dry herring still had the same taste on a piece of toast, that the waterfalls in the village still took on a perfumed smell at dusk. They were the notebook pages again, woven with the purple scribbling, in which he dedicated a special paragraph to each one. Nevertheless, and although he himself did not seem to notice it, those letters of recuperation and stimulation were slowly changing into pastoral letters of disenchantment. One winter night, while the soup was boiling in the fireplace, he missed the heat of the back of his store, the buzzing of the sun on the dusty almond trees, the whistle of the train during the lethargy of siesta time, just as in Macondo he had missed the winter soup in the fireplace, the cries of the coffee vendor, and the fleeting larks of springtime. Upset by two nostalgias facing each other like two mirrors, he lost his marvelous sense of unreality, and he ended up recommending to all of them that they leave Macondo, that they forget everything he had taught them about the world and the human heart, that they shit on Horace, and that wherever they might be, they always remember that the past was a lie, that memory has no return, that every spring gone by could never be recovered, and that the wildest and most tenacious love was an ephemeral truth in the end. Álvaro was the first to take the advice to abandon Macondo. He sold everything, even the tame jaguar that teased passers-by from the courtyard of his house, and he bought an eternal ticket on a train that never stopped travelling. In the postcards that he sent from the way stations, he would describe, with shouts, the instantaneous images that he had seen from the window of his coach, and it was as if he were tearing up and throwing into oblivion some long evanescent poem. The chimerical negroes in the cotton fields of Louisiana, the winged horses in the bluegrass of Kentucky, the Greek lovers in the infernal sunsets of Arizona, the girl in the red sweater painting watercolors by a lake in Michigan, who waved at him with her brushes, not to say farewell, but out of hope, because she did not know that she was watching a train with no return passing by. Then Alfonso and Germán left one Saturday, with the idea of coming back on Monday, but nothing more was ever heard of them. A year after the departure of the wise Catalonian, the only one left in Macondo was Gabriel, still adrift at the mercy of Nigromanta's chancy charity, and answering the questions of a contest in a French magazine, in which the first prize was a trip to Paris. Aureliano, who was the one who subscribed to it, helped him fill in the answers, sometimes in his house, but most of the time among the ceramic bottles and atmosphere of Valerian, in the only pharmacy left in Macondo, where Mercedes, Gabriel's stealthy girlfriend, lived. It was the last that remained of a past whose annihilation had not taken place, because it was still in a process of annihilation, consuming itself from within, ending at every moment, but never ending its ending. The town had reached such extremes of inactivity that when Gabriel won the contest and left for Paris with two changes of clothing, a pair of shoes, and the complete works of Rabelais, he had to signal the engineer to stop the train and pick him up. The old street of the Turks was at that time an abandoned corner where the last Arabs were letting themselves be dragged off to death with the age-old custom of sitting in their doorways, although it had been many years since they had sold the last yard of diagonal cloth, and in the shadowy showcases only the decapitated mannequins remained. The Banana Company's city, which Patricia Brown may have tried to evoke for her grandchildren during the nights of intolerance and dill pickles in Prattville, Alabama, was a plain of wild grass. The ancient priest who had taken Father Angel's place, and whose name no one had bothered to find out, awaited God's mercy stretched out casually in a hammock, tortured by arthritis and the insomnia of doubt, while the lizards and rats fought over the inheritance of the nearby church. In that Macondo, forgotten even by the birds, where the dust and the heat had become so strong that it was difficult to breathe, secluded by solitude and love, and by the solitude of love, in a house where it was almost impossible to sleep because of the noise of the red ants, Aureliano and Amaranta Ursula were the only happy beings, and the most happy on the face of the earth. Gaston had returned to Brussels, tired of waiting for the airplane. One day he put his indispensable things into a small suitcase, took his file of correspondence, and left with the idea of returning by air before his concession was turned over to a group of German pilots who had presented the provincial authorities with a more ambitious project than his. Since the afternoon of their first love, Aureliano and Amaranta Ursula had continued taking advantage of her husband's rare unguarded moments, making love with gagged ardor in chance meetings and almost always interrupted by unexpected returns. But when they saw themselves alone in the house, they succumbed to the delirium of lovers who were making up for lost time. It was a mad passion, unhinging, which made Fernanda's bones tremble with horror in her grave and which kept them in a state of perpetual excitement. Amaranta Ursula's shrieks, her songs of agony, would break out the same at 2 in the afternoon on the dining-room table as at 2 in the morning in the pantry. "What hurts me most," she would say, laughing, "is all the time that we wasted." In the bewilderment of passion, she watched the ants devastating the garden, sating their prehistoric hunger with the beams of the house, and she watched the torrents of living lava take over the porch again, but she bothered to fight them only when she found them in her bedroom. Aureliano abandoned the parchments, did not leave the house again, and carelessly answered the letters from the wise Catalonian. They lost their sense of reality, the notion of time, the rhythm of daily habits. They closed the doors and windows again, so as not to waste time getting undressed, and they walked about the house as Remedios the Beauty had wanted to do, and they would roll around naked in the mud of the courtyard. And one afternoon they almost drowned as they made love in the cistern. In a short time they did more damage than the red ants. They destroyed the furniture in the parlour. In their madness they tore to shreds the hammock that had resisted the sad bivouac loves of Colonel Aureliano Buendia, and they disemboweled the mattresses and emptied them on the floor as they suffocated in storms of cotton. Although Aureliano was just as ferocious a lover as his rival, it was Amaranta Ursula who ruled in that paradise of disaster, with her mad genius and her lyrical veracity, as if she had concentrated in her love the unconquerable energy that her great-great-grandmother had given to the making of little candy animals. And yet, while she was singing with pleasure and dying with laughter over her own inventions, Aureliano was becoming more and more absorbed and silent, for his passion was self-centered and burning. Nevertheless, they both reached such extremes of virtuosity that when they became exhausted from excitement, they would take advantage of their fatigue. They would give themselves over to the worship of their bodies, discovering that the rest periods in love had unexplored possibilities, much richer than those of desire. While he would rub Amaranta Ursula's erect breasts with egg whites, or smooth her elastic thighs and peach-like stomach with cocoa butter, she would play with Aureliano's portentous creature as if it were a doll, and would paint clown's eyes on it with her lipstick, and give it a Turk's mustache with her eyebrow pencil, and would put on organza bow ties and little tinfoil hats. One night they daubed themselves from head to toe with peach jam, and licked each other like dogs, and made mad love on the floor of the porch, and they were awakened by a torrent of carnivorous ants who were ready to eat them alive. During the pauses in their delirium, Amaranta Ursula would answer Gaston's letters. She felt him to be so far away and busy that his return seemed impossible to her. In one of his first letters, he told her that his partners had actually sent the airplane, but that a shipping agent in Brussels had sent it, by mistake, to Tanganyika, where it was delivered to the scattered tribe of the Makondos. That mix-up brought on so many difficulties that just to get the plane back might take 2 years. So Amaranta Ursula dismissed the possibility of an inopportune return. Aureliano, for his part, had no other contact with the world except for the letters from the wise Catalonian and the news he had of Gabrielle through Mercedes, the silent pharmacist. At first, they were real contacts. Gabrielle had turned in his return ticket in order to stay in Paris, selling the old newspapers and empty bottles that the chambermaids threw out of a gloomy hotel on the Rue Dauphine. Aureliano could visualize him then in a turtleneck sweater, which he took off only when the sidewalk cafes of Montparnasse filled with springtime lovers, and sleeping by day and writing by night, in order to confuse hunger in the room that smelled of boiled cauliflower, where Rocamadour was to die. Nevertheless, news about him was slowly becoming so uncertain, and the letters from the wise man so sporadic and melancholy, that Aureliano grew to think about them as Amaranta Ursula thought about her husband, and both of them remained floating in an empty universe, where the only everyday and eternal reality was love. Suddenly, like a stampede in that world of happy unawareness, came the news of Gaston's return. Aureliano and Amaranta Ursula opened their eyes, dug deep into their souls, looked at the letter with their hands on their hearts, and understood that they were so close to each other that they preferred death to separation. Then she wrote her husband a letter of contradictory truths, in which she repeated her love, and said how anxious she was to see him again, but at the same time she admitted, as a design of fate, the impossibility of living without Aureliano. Contrary to what they had expected, Gaston sent them a calm, almost paternal reply, with 2 whole pages devoted to a warning against the fickleness of passion, and a final paragraph with unmistakable wishes for them to be as happy as he had been during his brief conjugal experience. It was such an unforeseen attitude that Amaranta Ursula felt humiliated by the idea that she had given her husband the pretext that he had wanted in order to abandon her to her fate. The rancor was aggravated 6 months later when Gaston wrote again from Leopoldville, where he had finally recovered the airplane, simply to ask them to ship him the velocipede, which, of all that he had left behind in Macondo, was the only thing that had any sentimental value for him. Aureliano bore Amaranta Ursula's spite patiently, and made an effort to show her that he could be as good a husband in adversity as in prosperity, and the daily needs that besieged them, when Gaston's last money ran out, created a bond of solidarity between them that was not as dazzling and heady as passion, but that let them make love as much and be as happy as during their uproarious and salacious days. At the time Pilar Ternera died, they were expecting a child. In the lethargy of her pregnancy, Amaranta Ursula tried to set up a business in necklaces made out of the backbones of fish, but except for Mercedes, who bought a dozen, she could not find any customers. Aureliano was aware for the first time that his gift for languages, his encyclopedic knowledge, his rare faculty for remembering the details of remote deeds and places without having been there, were as useless as the box of genuine jewelry that his wife owned, which must have been worth as much as all the money that the last inhabitants of Macondo could have put together. They survived miraculously. Although Amaranta Ursula did not lose her good humour or her genius for erotic mischief, she acquired the habit of sitting on the porch after lunch, in a kind of wakeful and thoughtful siesta. Aureliano would accompany her. Sometimes they would remain there in silence until nightfall, opposite each other, looking into each other's eyes, loving each other as much as in their scandalous days. The uncertainty of the future made them turn their hearts toward the past. They saw themselves in the lost paradise of the deluge, splashing in the puddles in the courtyard, killing lizards to hang on Ursula, pretending that they were going to bury her alive. And those memories revealed to them the truth that they had been happy together ever since they had had memory. Going deeper into the past, Amaranta Ursula remembered the afternoon on which she had gone into the silver shop, and her mother told her that little Aureliano was nobody's child, because he had been found floating in a basket. Although the version seemed unlikely to them, they did not have any information enabling them to replace it with the true one. All that they were sure of, after examining all the possibilities, was that Fernando was not Aureliano's mother. Amaranta Ursula was inclined to believe that he was the son of Petra Cotes, of whom she remembered only tales of infamy, and that supposition produced a twinge of horror in her heart. Tormented by the certainty that he was his wife's brother, Aureliano ran out to the parish house to search through the moldy and moth-eaten archives for some clue to his parentage. The oldest baptismal certificate that he found was that of Amaranta Buendia, baptized in adolescence by Father Nicanor Reyna, during the time when he was trying to prove the existence of God by means of tricks with chocolate. He began to have that feeling that he was one of the 17 Aurelianos, whose birth certificates he tracked down as he went through 4 volumes, but the baptism dates were too far back for his age. Seeing him lost in the labyrinths of kinship, trembling with uncertainty, the arthritic priest, who was watching him from his hammock, asked him compassionately what his name was. "Aureliano Buendia," he said. "Then don't wear yourself out searching," the priest exclaimed with final conviction. "Many years ago there used to be a street here with that name, and in those days people had the custom of naming their children after streets." Aureliano trembled with rage. "So," he said, "you don't believe it either." "Believe what? That Colonel Aureliano Buendia fought 32 civil wars and lost them all?" Aureliano answered. "That the army hemmed in and machine-gunned 3,000 workers, and that their bodies were carried off to be thrown into the sea on a train with 200 cars." The priest measured him with a pitying look. "Oh, my son," he sighed, "it's enough for me to be sure that you and I exist at this moment." So Aureliano and Amaranta Ursula accepted the version of the basket, not because they believed it, but because it spared them their terror. As the pregnancy advanced, they were becoming a single being. They were becoming more and more integrated in the solitude of a house that needed only one last breath to be knocked down. They restricted themselves to an essential area, from Fernanda's bedroom, where the charms of sedentary love were visible, to the beginning of the porch, where Amaranta Ursula would sit to sew booties and bonnets for the newborn baby, and Aureliano would answer the occasional letters from the wise Catalonian. The rest of the house was given over to the tenacious assault of destruction. The silver shop, Melquiades' room, the primitive and silent realm of Santa Sofia de la Piedad remained in the depths of a domestic jungle that no one would have had the courage to penetrate. Surrounded by the voracity of nature, Aureliano and Amaranta Ursula continued cultivating the oregano and the begonias, and defended their world with demarcations of quicklime, building the last trenches in the age-old war between man and ant. Her long and neglected hair, the splotches that were beginning to appear on her face, the swelling of her legs, the deformation of her former love-making weasel's body, had changed Amaranta Ursula from the youthful creature she had been when she arrived at the house with the cage of luckless canaries and her captive husband. But it did not change the vivacity of her spirit. "Shit," she would say, laughing, "who would have thought that we really would end up living like cannibals?" The last thread that joined them to the world was broken on the 6th month of pregnancy, when they received a letter that obviously was not from the wise Catalonian. It had been mailed in Barcelona, but the envelope was addressed in conventional blue ink by an official hand, and it had the innocent and impersonal look of hostile messages. Aureliano snatched it out of Amaranta Ursula's hands as she was about to open it. "Not this one," he told her. "I don't want to know what it says." Just as he had sensed, the wise Catalonian did not write again. The stranger's letter, which no one read, was left to the mercy of the moths on the shelf where Fernanda had forgotten her wedding ring on occasion, and there it remained, consuming itself in the inner fire of its bad news, as the solitary lovers sailed against the tide of those days of the last stages, those impenitent and ill-fated times, which were squandered on the useless effort of making them drift toward the desert of disenchantment and oblivion. Aware of that menace, Aureliano and Amaranta Ursula spent the last months holding hands, ending with the love of loyalty for the child who had his beginning in the madness of fornication. At night, holding each other in bed, they were not frightened by the sublunary explosions of the ants, or the noise of the moths, or the constant and clean whistle of the growth of the weeds in the neighboring rooms. Many times they were awakened by the traffic of the dead. They could hear Ursula fighting against the laws of creation to maintain the line, and José Arcadio Buendía searching for the mythical truth of the great inventions, and Fernanda praying, and Colonel Aureliano Buendía stupefying himself with the deception of war and the little gold fishes, and Aureliano Segundo dying of solitude in the turmoil of his debauches. And then they learned that dominant obsessions can prevail against death, and they were happy again with the certainty that they would go on loving each other in their shape as apparitions, long after other species of future animals would steal from the insects the paradise of misery that the insects were finally stealing from man. One Sunday, at 6 in the afternoon, Amaranta Ursula felt the pangs of childbirth. The smiling mistress of the little girls who went to bed because of hunger had her get onto the dining room table, straddled her stomach, and mistreated her with wild gallops, until her cries were drowned out by the bellows of a formidable male child. Through her tears, Amaranta Ursula could see that he was one of those great Buendías, strong and willful like the José Arcadios, with the open and clairvoyant eyes of the Aurelianos, and predisposed to begin the race again from the beginning, and cleanse it of its pernicious vices and solitary calling, for he was the only one in a century who had been engendered with love. "He's a real cannibal," she said. "We'll name him Rodrigo." "No," her husband countered, "we'll name him Aureliano, and he'll win 32 wars." After cutting the umbilical cord, the midwife began to use a cloth to take off the blue grease that covered his body as Aureliano held up a lamp. Only when they turned him on his stomach did they see that he had something more than other men, and they leaned over to examine him. It was the tail of a pig. They were not alarmed. Aureliano and Amaranta Ursula were not aware of the family precedent, nor did they remember Ursula's frightening admonitions, and the midwife pacified them with the idea that the tail could be cut off when the child got his second teeth. Then they had no time to think about it again, because Amaranta Ursula was bleeding in an uncontainable torrent. They tried to help her with applications of spiderwebs and balls of ash, but it was like trying to hold back a spring with one's hands. During the first hours she tried to maintain her good humor. She took the frightened Aureliano by the hand and begged him not to worry, because people like her were not made to die against their will, and she exploded with laughter at the ferocious remedies of the midwife. But as Aureliano's hope abandoned him, she was becoming less visible, as if the light on her were fading away, until she sank into drowsiness. At dawn on Monday, they brought a woman who recited cauterizing prayers that were infallible for man and beast beside her bed. But Amaranta Ursula's passionate blood was insensible to any artifice that did not come from love. In the afternoon, after 24 hours of desperation, they knew that she was dead, because the flow had stopped without remedies, and her profile became sharp, and the blotches on her face evaporated in a halo of alabaster, and she smiled again. Aureliano did not understand until then how much he loved his friends, how much he missed them, and how much he would have given to be with them at that moment. He put the child in the basket that his mother had prepared for him, covered the face of the corpse with a blanket, and wandered aimlessly through the town, searching for an entrance that went back to the past. He knocked at the door of the pharmacy, where he had not visited lately, and he found a carpenter shop. The old woman who opened the door with a lamp in her hand took pity on his delirium, and insisted that, no, there had never been a pharmacy there, nor had she ever known a woman with her thin neck and sleepy eyes named Mercedes. He wept, leaning his brow against the door of the wise Catalonian's former bookstore, conscious that he was paying with his tardy sobs for a death that he had refused to weep for on time, so as not to break the spell of love. He smashed his fists against the cement wall of the Golden Child, calling for Pilar Tenera, indifferent to the luminous orange discs that were crossing the sky, and that so many times on holiday nights he had contemplated with childish fascination from the courtyard of the Curlews. In the last open salon of the tumble-down red-light district, an accordion group was playing the songs of Rafael Escalona, the bishop's nephew, heir to the secrets of Francisco the Man. The bartender, who had a withered and somewhat crumpled arm because he had raised it against his mother, invited Aureliano to have a bottle of cane liquor, and Aureliano then bought him one. The bartender spoke to him about the misfortune of his arm. Aureliano spoke to him about the misfortune of his heart, withered and somewhat crumpled for having been raised against his sister. They ended up weeping together, and Aureliano felt for a moment that the pain was over. But when he was alone again in the last dawn of Macondo, he opened up his arms in the middle of the square, ready to wake up the whole world, and he shouted with all his might, "Friends are a bunch of bastards!" Nigromanta rescued him from a pool of vomit and tears. She took him to her room, cleaned him up, made him drink a cup of broth. Thinking that it would console him, she took a piece of charcoal and erased the innumerable loves that he still owed her for, and she voluntarily brought up her own most solitary sadnesses, so as not to leave him alone in his weeping. When he awoke, after a dull and brief sleep, Aureliano recovered the awareness of his headache. He opened his eyes and remembered the child. He could not find the basket. At first he felt an outburst of joy, thinking that Amaranta Ursula had awakened from death to take care of the child. But her corpse was a pile of stones under the blanket. Aware that when he arrived he had found the door to the bedroom open, Aureliano went across the porch, which was saturated with the morning sighs of oregano, and looked into the dining room, where the remnants of the berth still lay. The large pot, the bloody sheets, the jars of ashes, and the twisted umbilical cord of the child on an open diaper on the table next to the shears and the fish line. The idea that the midwife had returned for the child during the night gave him a pause of rest in which to think. He sank into the rocking chair, the same one in which Rebecca had sat during the early days of the house to give embroidery lessons, and in which Amaranta had played Chinese checkers with Colonel Gerineldo Marquez, and in which Amaranta Ursula had sewn the tiny clothing for the child. And in that flash of lucidity, he became aware that he was unable to bear in his soul the crushing weight of so much past. Wounded by the fatal lances of his own nostalgia, and that of others, he admired the persistence of the spiderwebs on the dead rose bushes, the perseverance of the ryegrass, the patience of the air in the radiant February dawn. And then he saw the child. It was a dry and bloated bag of skin that all the ants in the world were dragging toward their holes along the stone path in the garden. Aureliano could not move, not because he was paralyzed by horror, but because at that prodigious instant Melchiades' final keys were revealed to him, and he saw the epigraph of the parchments perfectly placed in the order of man's time and space. "The first of the line is tied to a tree, and the last is being eaten by the ants." Aureliano had never been more lucid in any act of his life as when he forgot about his dead ones and the pain of his dead ones, and nailed up the doors and windows again with Fernanda's crossed boards, so as not to be disturbed by any temptations of the world. For he knew then that his fate was written in Melchiades' parchments. He found them intact among the prehistoric plants and steaming puddles and luminous insects that had removed all trace of man's passage on earth from the room, and he did not have the calmness to bring them out into the light, but right there, standing, without the slightest difficulty, as if they had been written in Spanish and were being read under the dazzling splendor of high noon, he began to decipher them aloud. It was the history of the family, written by Melchiades, down to the most trivial details, 100 years ahead of time. He had written it in Sanskrit, which was his mother tongue, and he had encoded the even lines in the private cipher of the Emperor Augustus, and the odd ones in a Lacedaemonian military code. The final protection, which Aureliano had begun to glimpse when he let himself be confused by the love of Amaranta Ursula, was based on the fact that Melchiades had not put events in the order of man's conventional time, but had concentrated a century of daily episodes in such a way that they coexisted in one instant,